This is DreamWords. Tom Corvin by Paul Storey. Chapter 47. The pain started as nothing more than the tingle he'd felt before in his arms and legs. Four circular straps, ankles and wrists, bristled as though the fabric had sprung a weave of miniature needles stabbing his skin. Tom tensed and tried to pull away from the weirdness of the effect. It was not quite pain, not yet. Rippling along his limbs, a thousand tiny hairs stood erect. Throughout his torso, his skin prickled, and nauseous waves of bile squirmed in his stomach as though a living thing stirred in its pit. As the tingle grew to an irritating itch and then to a mild burn, Tom's neck strained taut. He wrenched on either wrist, willing the bands to snap. Seconds later, phantom acid washed his body and the horror began. On the other side of the cubicle door, Silas stabbed another key with theatrical aplomb. He looked mad, a crazy conductor orchestrating a hellish band of invisible musicians piping Tom towards a nightmare grave. Terrible as this was, the discomfort of his body was nothing to that of his mind. The buzzing seemed to start at his fingers and toes, quickly running inwards until every inch of him was alive with subsurface points of living, crawling flesh. His left arm, apparently stronger, it pulled taut against its restraining band. The fabric thinning, crinkling, biting hard and deep, soaking red as it gouged and bled him. Tom watched horrified as his body pimpled, boils erupting violently, his skin a seething mass of boiling, bubbling fat. Each eruption pushed outwards and each vibrated to Silas's tune, quivering wildly as though there really was an insect under every single one of them, Tom a host to the parasitic birth of 10,000 furious flies, and to his horror, blood dripping on the cubicle floor, that thought became a premonition. Just above his bleeding wrist, a cluster of wiggling bumps seemed to come alive, tiny beasts thrusting outwards from his arm, and from that small area, the cancerous spot spread, blackening and cracking, the buzzing fury amplifying the boy's rising terror. Tom pulled, snapped his hands up, both wrists bleeding now, twisting, the bands wrinkled and thin but still binding tight. Something poked a tiny albino head through a single hole in his forearm, and then another, and another, and another. Throughout his body, seen and unseen, exposed skin and hidden, they emerged. Beneath his shirt, the back of his knees, and between his legs, an army of white bugs crawled from their burrows, turning their heads this way and that, brushing their antennae, unfolding, preening their wings, the noise now the sound of a million skittish violins. And then they were free, his skin in shreds. Each boil harbored more than one insect. Behind each birth, a hideous, pale sibling followed, one trailing the other. They filled the cubicle, swarming back towards him until he was covered in the things. He clamped his mouth, teeth and jaws and lips locked hard against their twins, straining air at an ever-decreasing gap at his flaring nose, and he found that passage too, probing and plodding, blocking his only hope for oxygen. This was Silas's work. What he saw, What he felt was not real. He believed this, in his heart and in his head. But still they were there. Still his skin bled, stripped and ripped, bubbled and burst. This wasn't real. It wasn't real. He closed his eyes, shutting the image from his sight. He tried to think beyond the cubicle, beyond Silas's tugging strings. It was all in his head. All in his head. Tom saw himself leave his body, watched Silas through blind eyes run to the cubicle, smash his fists on the door. But Tom ignored them, focused on the only thoughts with the power to lift him from that place, that state of being. And the infernal buzzing followed. He searched his mind, an Olympian effort amidst the swarm colonizing his thoughts. His mother, the glimpse fleeting, held him and twirled his well-loved self to Tessa's fiddle. But now he saw the cubicle again, his skin, the white plague, Silas's mad face, all through closed eyes. He shook his head, opened his eyelids, closed them again, buried his chin to his chest, shook himself and shook himself, but still they came. He thought of Catriona, of the door closing between them at Craigan, and as he did, Silas's rage dimmed, the heavy weight of crawling bodies lightened. The pain in his wrists, a welcome sense of reality that cut through the illusion this surely was. Catriona's dark hair, indistinct, waving gently, shiny organized smoke among the fog. He drew himself to her, straightened from the seat to close the distance between them. She seemed to drift away from his face, the background of the cottage fading, her features strengthening. Without realizing he was doing it, Tom's whole body strained to follow her. He could not return to the cubicle, would not return. But somewhere in his mind, the pull of the machine, Silas's hypnotic probe, threatened to rip him back. He could sense its subtle tug on his subconscious. He was about to lose it all. Catriona began to fade, and somewhere inside Tom, something snapped. The buzzing stopped, just like that. And in the sudden silence, in some crazy world where nothing made sense, the chair left him. When he escaped, Tom had no idea what happened. The sense of it hidden amid the miasma of conflicting images, battling sounds and a deluge of sensory data making up the awful world he thought he was doomed to die in. What was certain was that when it did happen, his eyes sprung open and he flew through the cubicle glass as though it was a projected and ephemeral barrier. But that description, almost logical in the realm of dreams, was not right. He flew nowhere. He did not seem to move at all. Rather, it was as though he sat still, and the bands holding him slid back and downwards with the chair. The fabric passed through his limbs as though they, or he, were wisps of air. The cubicle leapt away from him. The lab shifted as though some giant had hauled it whole and without damage, and thrust it 20 feet back and down through the earth. The glass did not shatter. Silas remained hammering on the door, and the world did not stand still for a heartbeat. In one instant it seemed to Tom as though the planet had just lurched away from him, and then stopped when he hung directly over Silas's control station. And as quickly as it happened it stopped, and Tom dropped like a bomb to the floor. He twisted, thrust his arms out to protect himself and crashed into the monitor. As he turned, he saw Silas do the same, and his bright sparks slammed into his face along with toughened glass, white plastic and hard steel. Silas started to scream, and Tom slipped into unconsciousness. Chapter 48. Before he opened his eyes, Tom sensed that he was moving. He forced himself to remain still. Sitting on a soft seat, his head jostled against cold glass. The thrum of tires on asphalt drove through his body, and every few seconds he felt himself alternately lift and fall from the structure that supported him. He ached, his battered body a patchwork of bruised blue that had somehow escaped serious injury. Every muscle was stressed and relaxed in his effort to remain still, a feat that, although uncomfortable, allowed him to test drive his mobility before committing himself to action. To his right, sensing a presence he assumed was Silas, Tom remembered his dream back in the cottage. He knew then, without looking, that it was dark, headlights sweeping through canyon trees. He tried to recall what else he'd seen, but a familiar voice iced his blood and he flung his eyes wide open.
"I know you're awake, boy."
Tom lifted himself slowly from his awkward lean, the aches and pains nothing to what he'd gone through earlier.
"You're a fool. You've ruined everything. It could have been so easy."
Tom looked at Silas, and somewhere in his head a voice warned, to no one in particular,
"Keep your eyes on the road."
Silas glanced sideways and made a show of fingering the ring, tapping it lightly against the steering wheel. Tom stared at it and realized that Silas still had no idea that it was useless. His gaze moved from the finger to the dark-eyed, pale orb glowering at him.
"What happened?"
Tom managed to croak. Looking at his tormentor, Tom almost expected to see his mouth slide over to his cheek. This was the same hideously disfigured man that had brought so much misery to his family.
"If you'd listened to me, you'd know what happened. You would be free. Your sister safe. We'd all be home."
I don't understand."
"You angered me. You made me hurt you."
"I was strapped. Then I wasn't. I mean, I flew out of the chair."
"You flew like a piece of dung. You ruined everything. The terminal, your chance of an easy ride."
Tom felt the hackles rise at the back of his neck at these words, and it was nothing to do with Silas invading his mind. He tried to ignore the implications and probed the man for more information. "Was it real?"
"Of course it was real!"
Silas shouted this, and Tom shrunk back to the door before he checked himself. He would not cower. He knew what he must do, and he was going to do it.
"But the straps, the glass."
An oncoming car swung wide around a bend and blinded them for a moment. Silas swerved, but otherwise paid no attention to the other car as it blasted into the rearview mirror and snaked behind him to a stop. He drove on, kicking the accelerator to the floor, swinging the wheel in the car around the bend.
"You're so close. I wanted this to be easy for you. No stress to steal your concentration."
Tom flared in anger and frustration. He knew it was stupid, but he could not help himself.
"How can I know what you want when you won't tell me?"
Silas lifted his hand, moving automatically on the ring, but another bend forced him to re-grip the wheel and screech the curve, forcing Tom tight against the door.
"I have waited for 140 years, boy. Do not try my patience. 5 minutes, and you would have known everything. Your temper, it makes you stupid."
"Where are we going?" Tom said this quietly, suddenly aware that travelling away from the lab did not make sense for a man so bent on using Tom to get home, whatever home was.
"It'll take days to fix your mess."
Tom was about to ask him if he had another lab somewhere when it clicked. He knew where they were headed.
"We're going to Cregan, aren't we?"
"You have a date with the girl. We wouldn't want to disappoint her."
His voice was low, the threat implicit. But still he pressed the point to Tom.
"We did it once before. I made you and your sister masters of your gift.
An insane thrill rushed through Tom at the thought of returning to Cregan, as though a part of him hoped that it would be to rescue her and not to bring a monster to her door. It disappeared almost immediately, and Tom pleaded with Silas.
No, take me back. We'll do it together. You need to teach me. Tell me what to do.
The sense of panic rose in his voice, and Tom knew that he had made a mistake. Silas grinned.
I will, Tom, he said. All we need is the right incentive, and everything will flood back to you.
They hurtled down a hill, overshadowed on either side by small grassy mountains, the one to their left close, the one on the right further back, and, even in the darkness, chilling in its familiarity. Somewhere out there, a path ran over the hill and down to his childhood sea.
Catriana, that's her name, isn't it? Not much younger than Kathleen when we first met.
Tom could not let this happen. He had to get to Cregan before Silas. He'd wondered what would make him jump from a moving car, and now he had it. He edged away from Silas, only partially feigning the shrinkage of his frame, fearing what the man was capable of. In the distance, another car approached him, the second on this journey through the desolate, slumbering island. Tom had a sudden hope that Catriana would be gone, but quickly realized it was probably wrong. She would have waited for him, hoping for a quick return, unable to desert her father as the hours ticked by. She would not leave him on his own, and at every moment she would have expected a helicopter, a boat, a rescue party, the police, or Tom himself to appear at the cottage. Only as the day drew to a close would she decide that something had gone wrong, and even then, her choices were still poor. Unless her father's condition forced her to do otherwise, she would leave him alone only when it was obvious that no one was coming. She would leave at first light. He knew that was true, as clearly as if he had been standing beside her listening to her thoughts. His hand crept to the door handle, and he pulled. DreamWorks.com.